most people, working class people. Why should we start with socialism? Because it's good for workers. End of story. Doesn't have to be just. It's just good for workers. And so adding that it's just for Marx was didn't add anything. It was just a fancy way of justifying what was really desirable just because it's what was good for workers. And if you were on the side of workers, you wanted what's good for them, not good for capitalists. Yeah.
But like Marx used a lot of words to describe capitalism, like used the word thief or robber to describe like capitalist. So does that imply that he means the capitalism is unjust?
Well, I think he was very inconsistent in the notion. So yes, so in the rhetoric of trying to condemn capitalism, you'd use words like theft and robbery and all sorts of nasty words to describe the system. But but when you actually get to ask the question, why should we oppose capitalism? The fundamental argument is not in Marx. It's not that it's unjust. It's just that it's bad for people. And being bad for people isn't the same as it being unjust. Yeah.
Can I comment on that language at least? Also, he refers to it as like the system itself as being like vampiric. And I mean, like that in the sense that it does, you know, metaphorically drain the life essence of people in the forms of relations of production. And also that capitalism itself is somewhat undead in that no matter what happens to it, it always resuscitates itself from the point of, or from the brink of, like, living death. You know, it always brings itself back in crisis.
And so those are all reasons why you might dislike capitalism. You might dislike vampires. But if you were a vampire, it's great to be a vampire. Right? So it's not an... And in the normal vampire metaphor, vampires aren't acting unfairly. They're just being vampires. They're just doing their thing. So... just like if you're walking in the woods and a grizzly bear attacks you, it's not unjust that the grizzly bear attacks you. That's just the grizzly bear doing its grizzly bear thing. Right? So from one point of view, you don't need all this discussion of justice. It's kind of an add-on. Yeah?
In using the terms exploitation in terms of, you know, the surplus, you know, the profit that's taken from workers that doesn't belong to them, doesn't that imbue an inherent sense of something that's unjust?
And so most, I would agree, that using an expression like exploitation, why would you use that term unless you also felt it was unfair? And there is a lot of language that has that aura to it. So my view is, in spite of Marx's explicit denunciation of discussions of justice, it reappears in all sorts of ways. But furthermore, beyond what Marx, the person, believed in how he practiced his own theoretical work, I think discussions of justice are important. Because among the motivations why people object to social structures are motivations driven by moral concern. And justice is an important aspect of our language of moral concern. Now, that particular way of talking about moral concern is something that came with capitalism. In particular, it is part of the liberal tradition. The talk of justice is very much bound up with notions of rights and violations of rights. But I don't think that is should be viewed as necessarily an indictment. You know, there's a tradition of Marxist thinking that does indict it just for that reason. I think it's a historic achievement that we've come to understand that moral concerns don't apply merely to individual behavior, which is an older idea about moral concerns, but they do apply to our institutions. And justice, the language of justice, is the lingua franca for talking about the indictment of institutions. Yeah.
So, could you just quickly maybe reconcile, for my mind, just the idea that there is the idea that Marxism has a moral imperative to it, where, you know, your foundational claim is that there are deficits in human flourishing, and how that relates to the fact that vampires are just doing their thing.
Right.
That is, you know, perhaps the richest people in our society are flourishing. Yes. You know, perhaps it's probably in their interest to continue capitalism. And so is human flourishing something that you can, you know, spread across evenly to an entire population, and aren't there competing interests?
Right. So, of course, the obstacle to spreading it across the entire population are precisely the powers that get associated with these competing interests. The fact that there's competing interests would not itself be sufficient to block universalizing the conditions of flourishing, unless the competing interests also corresponded to differentials in power. It's the combination of conflictual interests plus a structure of power relations associated with those interests that blocks our ability to create a world in which everyone has access to the conditions of flourishing. Now, I think it's important to add these normative foundations. That is, what are the moral issues involved? And I am comfortable using the language of justice, in spite of their liberal pedigree. This way of talking came into our philosophical vocabulary via 19th century liberalism and its 20th century developments. Because I think that these were intellectual achievements and political achievements, but which the full realization of which is itself blocked by our existing institutions. But let me then tell you how I would frame the normative foundations. This is discussed in the chapter that you read today, chapter 1 of Visioning of Utopias. These are, of course, I should say, I think it's obvious, these are very difficult issues. These are not simple matters to really nail down what the theory of justice that we want to connect to an emancipatory project. But this is the way I would frame it. I think that there's really two closely connected aspects of justice bound up with an emancipatory social science. The first I call social justice and the second political justice. So by social justice I mean the following. And this is coming straight from the Envisioning of Utopias chapter. In a just society, all people have equal access to the necessary material and social means to live a flourishing life. And political justice means, in a politically just society, all people have equal access to the necessary political means to participate meaningfully in decisions which affect their lives. This political justice idea has really two dimensions. This includes both the freedom of individuals to make choices that affect their own lives as individuals, as separate persons, and it refers to their capacity to participate in collective decisions which affect their lives as members of the community. The second term, the second condition, that is the equal access to the necessary conditions to participate in collective decisions, that relationship we identify with the word democracy. People having a capacity to fully participate in decisions which affect their own lives as individuals, we typically refer to as liberty. Now, in the liberal discussion of these matters, individual freedom and democracy, or liberty and democracy, are seen as in tension with each other, as being different values. I think they are the same value, just applied to different contexts. I think a good term for the general value is self-governance. That is, in a just society, people have equal access to the necessary conditions for self-governance. What self-governance means is when it's a matter of making choices that affect you and only you, you should have complete control over those choices. You shouldn't be forced to do things that only affect yourself. But when you're making choices that affect other people, by virtue of our interconnectedness with other people, they should be parties to decisions. You shouldn't be able to make choices which have big ramifications for the lives of others without them being party to the deliberations around these decisions. One way of thinking about the demarcation between these two realms of decision-making, of choice-making, of action, is to use the terms public and private. That there's a boundary between the public and the private. The private are those things which are legitimately restricted to your own autonomous choice making. Nobody has any business telling you what to do. The public are all those things for which the decisions that have to be made should be made collectively by all people affected by those public decisions. Now, the boundary between those is hopelessly ambiguous, necessarily ambiguous. The complexity of our interconnections make it impossible to have a clean boundary between public and private. And therefore, the boundary itself is a subject of public deliberation. And different institutions, different social structures draw that boundary differently. And it'll always be contested. The capitalist way of drawing that boundary expands the private way, way into the public. So all sorts of decisions, all sorts of choices that have massive effects on other people are made privately. That's essentially what it means to have a capitalist property relations. The owners of a firm have the capacity to decide to move it to a different place, even though this will be devastating to the lives of all sorts of people. That's not a decision which should be allowed to be made privately, because it's not a decision that only affects the person making the decision. But because of the way capitalist society, in its liberal forms especially, but capitalists define the nature of the public-private distinction, the private encroaches massively into the public. The recognition of that, though, doesn't tell you where to draw that line. And it is a deep, not a simple problem for socialists to figure out where the line should be drawn. How to create an authentic democratic public that still respects the autonomy of individuals to control their own lives. That's a difficult issue. And when socialists think it's a simple matter, just socializing means production, they're kidding themselves. It's not a simple matter. It's a hugely complicated matter. And it's one of the sources, I think, of ambiguity in the project of transforming capitalism. Yeah?
So I know in the chapter there was a footnote when you were discussing the theory of justice, and you talked about how there might be criticisms, especially I would imagine from modern anthropology, that it's ethnocentric, you know. I mean, the idea that that there's this distinction between private and public, people should have the autonomous control over those private decisions. It's conceivable to think of cultures before contact, before Western imperialism, that have cosmologies, even their theories of the universe, that don't make those distinctions, isn't it? I mean,
but I don't believe there's any society that didn't even practice the distinction, whether they make it as a cognitive category or not. That is, once we have language and culture and ability to communicate with each other, so once we're talking about a world in which culture is something we produce as opposed to something which is just our behaviors and interactions are just inscribed in our genetic makeup. I don't believe there's any culture in which there isn't a distinction between things people do just on their own choices and things which they do in collaboration with others. Whether that gets symbolically represented as a boundary or not, there is still the distinction in practice.
And you think, I mean, there is this normative thing, you know, it has a lot of, I mean, it's about morality, it's about doing the right thing, really, justice. You know, in these societies where there might be, you know, it might be a shaman, you know, there might be a shaman or some sort of religious leader who makes collective decisions because people don't feel necessarily that they have the authority to make those decisions because it's tied to their worldview, right? I mean, how do you reconcile the fact that only after capitalism comes to those places and they're viewed in the sense of, you know, what is the things that transforming their world to something, you know, without it would be a better decision for them than before, you know? I mean,
so we get into extremely difficult questions when we ask, as a completely transhistorical matter, is it always the case that equal access to the necessary means to participate in collective decisions is a condition for human flourishing? And so on. If you make this as a completely transhistorical, as opposed to saying in the world in which we find ourselves, it's true that human beings will flourish more in general if they have equal access to the means to flourish, and that their lives will go better by criteria that they will recognize. Their children will be happier, their sense of frustration and alienation will be reduced under these more egalitarian democratic conditions. So I'm prepared to make very strong claims about these normative principles as they apply to complex developed societies of the sort that we find ourselves in. Now, my intuition is that it applies more broadly than that. I don't believe it is the case that people flourished in the sense of had the full capacity to realize their potentials. Flourishing means the ability to fully realize your potentials under conditions of where life expectancies were, you know, in the 30s, and people didn't have written culture to be able to develop their capacities and talents beyond a very limited and narrow way. So I'm prepared to make the stronger claim, but I can't fully defend it. I don't think, however, I think that the cultural relativist critique of it doesn't actually damage the crucial questions about the desirability of transforming capitalism in order to realize these normative ideals, and that the unfair distribution of suffering. So remember, the foundational empirical claim is that our institutions create much human suffering. The normative claim is that what suffering there is unfairly distributed. Some people suffer more than others. Some people have more deficits than. And the unfairness of that distribution is what the normative claims is. Yeah.
In the book, you discussed that when you have social justice and political justice, it's this idea of democratic egalitarianism. Do you see these two concepts as intertwined? That is, to have political justice, do you need social justice? And to have social justice, do you need political justice? Or do you think that you can have, are these concepts kind of side by side running parallel to each other, that you can have political justice without the other?
Okay, so these are two distinguishable values. So there's two issues in play, and therefore we should care about them both. And in addition, there's causal connections between the institutions that block or facilitate both. So the causal connection is a social science problem. To what extent can political inequality coexist with improvements in social equality? Or are these causally so closely tied that you can only make advances in one when you make advances in the other? I think there's some slippage between the two empirically, but it is possible to make advances on one. Independently of the extent to which you've made advances on the other. But I also believe that in order to have a stable equilibrium, to have a stable social structure within which you're sustaining advances in social justice, it's hard to see how that would happen under conditions of without improving democracy as well. We'll get into the causal arguments about this later, especially at the end of the semester where we put it all together in our discussions of socialism. Yeah.
This is what we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you how you use the normative concerns to guide your research agendas,
Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about this recently. For those of you who don't know, I'm the current president of the American Sociological Association, and one of the things that you end up being preoccupied with is what you're going to say when you give your presidential address in August of 2012. And you get elected 2 years in advance. You got a lot of time to obsess about this, I tell you. And so one issue is exactly how much, what role does the specific social justice issue play in my framing of this? I think that my biggest indictment of capitalism is just that it creates unnecessary human suffering and unnecessary deficits that we can flourish in, that we can get rid of if we could transcend these power relations and the social structures that support them. And that's way more important in the end than my view that, in addition to that, what's bad about capitalism is that some people flourish and others don't. It's that there's a lot of people who don't flourish that could flourish under an alternative system. So, in a sense, I have a more utilitarian, that's a more utilitarian view. The alternatives would just be better for most people. That's really the part of my argument. And the distributional aspects of injustice don't figure as strongly as I used to think. So when I wrote Envisioning Moved Utopias, I emphasized the justice issues in that first chapter, which kind of sets the stage for what follows. And now I'm thinking that that is actually less really at the core. We are really out of time, as, you know, for people who have to scurry off. This is going to be a chronic problem. There's a general issue about running out of time. I will post my lecture notes. And in general, if I insist on always trying to finish up in the next class what we didn't get to in the previous one, then we fall further and further behind as we march on. So I will look through this and see what are the absolutely bottom line things I need to add from today's lecture. But you can, in any case, read my notes online. And I'll see you on number 9.